What's up, my
brother? What up, my boy? How you doing, man?
Good to see you.
You good, baby? Larcy, I'm going to tell you these stories later.
Bro, we got to talk about them on air, man.
Oh, man. LT done stole my soul a couple times.
Hey, LT had people in Pittsburgh thought I couldn't play. They said, man, they say all we remember was when LT stiff-armed you on the walk-off.
Came too fast, though. Hey, you came down, and I was like, whoa.
Larcy, look at them two motherfuckers in the cross from us. Come on, man.
We lose that game. If this the first four people that walk out the bus, if it's me and you and Freddie T and LT on their side, it's an L.
I'm betting on them.
Oklahoma, I'm always like sitting in the front of the bus, though. Like, I sat in that first seat.
Really?
Yeah, because I seen Junior. That was like the kind of the tradition.
Okay.
Top dogs with the Chargers, Junior say I always sat in that first chair. And so, of course, you come into that locker room, you see how everything goes. You get on that bus and Junior is right there. He kind of is like setting the tempo, right? Like, hey, this thing is serious. When I get off this bus, it's time to go. And so that torch was passed and I felt like, you know, I had to represent it by sitting in that first seat.
Did you sit in the first seat once Junior left?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. No, you couldn't sit in that seat.
I didn't know if you could sit next to him. You sit on the opposite side. No,
So it was all the leaders. So you would have obviously Junior Seau, Rodney Harrison.
Yeah.
You know, all those guys were in those seats. And the rookies, which I was at the time, you know, you sat in the back. Oh, I got a chance to sit in the middle because I was a first round pick.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I got a chance to sit in the middle.
Hold up. Limitless. Take a stomach cap, pinning it. I fought the head to witness it. Get my people feeling militant. Way I'm finna get me up. On the mission, get me up. Knowing me, I got the key. Only vision I can trust. Trust. Limitless. Take a stomach cap, pinning it. I fought the head to witness it. Get my people feeling militant. Way I'm finna get me up. On the mission, get me up. Knowing me, I got the key.
Welcome to the Pivot, man. We are honored to have you. Chan, Freddie T. Obviously, I'm Ryan. You know, you remember me if you go back. I think it was like 2005, overtime, bam. Yeah, that was me, the guy on the other end of it. And this thing, hey, look, no, I couldn't even reach. But you know, hey, you know how when you get embarrassed on the way down to the ground on the stiff arm? So amazingly, you pop up quick. I got up that ground so fast, no hands.
I just got you one time. It was at the wrong time. You know what I mean? It was at the wrong time.
We are 2 of 1,000 that have stories about LT getting their ass destroyed.
I have a question. That brings me to a question, right? So when we're giving out the stiff arm, because I done been on that end of the stiff arm before, and I know what it feel like to get them down, right? What does it feel like when you like looking up, reaching for God?
Like, it feels like you got arms of a little person, right? Of a dwarf. Because what happened with LT is if nobody's on that side of y'all, not only are y'all stiff arming us, but y'all running away too. Right, it ain't nothing we could do, bro. It's honestly the most helpless feeling, and you also know how bad it looked.
Well, I was jump cutting at the same time, because I saw you kind of out my peripheral to the right. Because, you know, when I hit the hole, I just seen some flashing coming hard. And I was, you know, I reacted like, whoa, because you was up on me so fast. And I was fortunate enough that you came to the side a little bit, so I was able to kind of get you off.
Hey, Freddie T.
Was he fortunate enough? Or that nigga Hall of Famer.
Hey, look, Chan, at that point, I was looking for Sean T. Sean, where you at? Save me.
But you heard what he say? He said, I was jump cutting at the same time.
Oh, he was.
That means you got a hat. Only a few got that.
Yeah, I mean, Hall of Famer, MVP in 06. You won the Doak Walker twice. Why in the hell would you come back to school after you win it the first time?
Actually, I didn't. Ron Dane won it my junior. I led the nation in rushing.
You had 1,800 that year.
Yes. And I thought I was going to win it, but they gave it to Ron Dane at that time. So I felt like I needed to come back to prove a point, you know. And I wanted to go for 2,000. I really wanted to get 2,000 yards.
Tell me about the day you went for 406 in one game against UTEP.
That was a special day. But here's the thing, man. Like, I felt like I had an awful first half. You know, well, I mean, I had 100 and some yards at the time, but I had a critical fumble. No, but I'm saying, listen to me now. Running backs, Freddie T, no. If you fumble at a critical time, you feel awful. Not to mention, I fumbled going into halftime, and we were about to score. So it was a critical moment. It was for the conference championship at that time that we were playing for, and my coach let me have it going into halftime. I mean, he hold on to the damn ball. Like, what the hell? You know, we got him right where we want him. So I went into halftime like, got to make it up. Came out that second half, but before that, let me back up. Before that, he said, I'm going to give you the damn ball the second half as much as you want. Like, get ready to tote the damn ball, and he walked away. And so, you know, I'm at the locker, like, I'm finna give it to these dudes. It's for the championship. And the second half, it was just like every run was a long run. Like chopping. And I got around 370-some yards, and it was in the fourth quarter, right? And we get to the point where we had actually sealed the game. I think I was around 380-something. I come off the field, and coach says, wait a minute. Like, you're 13, 14 yards away from getting 400. No one has ever done that. He said, do you want to do it? I said, coach, game over. I don't care about that. He said, no, get this 400. Get back in the game. Had a couple more carries that took me over 400 to 406.
Man, that's 4 weeks. Of football for a good back.
You're sitting back like, God damn, like these numbers. But truth be told, one fumble is probably equivalent to like negative 100 yards.
Yeah,
really? That beats you up more than anything as a back, because that's the one sin.
Yeah.
You can't play if you can't hold on to the ball. But my question to you, LT, is in this day and age, RC asked you, why did you go back? With NIL and all that stuff, would you have left school? Like, why didn't you leave? You had 1,800, even though you didn't. Yeah. When the dope walk, I know you say you had a chip on your shoulder. Like, for a lot of guys, the numbers, knowing how great they were, wanting to test their abilities against guys in the next level, why didn't you want to go and make that leap and go and get paid doing it?
Yeah, so you know how we get that projection after your junior year of where you're projected to be drafted. It was third round for me, third round. And part of that was because of the conference I played in, going to TCU, a small private school. They actually didn't know if I can catch the ball, bro. Like, they didn't know if I could catch it. We ran the option. We were always on the perimeter, you know? And so I just felt like I had a point to prove, to go back and prove that I'm the best running back at this time. And really, it was Deuce McAllister.
Yep.
Deuce was the standard at that time, right? Yeah. Deuce was big, fast, had moves, can catch, all that stuff. So I was... you know, chasing after Deuce at that time. Wow. If it was NIL, though.
Might have stayed for five.
Hey, you might stay a little bit longer, especially when I'm hearing from, you know, Marvin Harrison Jr., they offering the young kid $20, $25 million to stay. Yep. I mean, think about that. He possibly can make more than his entire rookie contract, possibly, you going back for 1 year. Why wouldn't you?
Gotta stay.
You gotta stay.
Like, are we making business decisions?
Yeah.
To be honest, but LT, I wanna see in that same thought process. When did you know that you were special? Because to your point, you're chasing Duke McAllister, but right now, let's be honest, you're in the Hall of Fame and he's not.
Yeah.
Freddie's trying to catch you because you're better than Freddie. I'm gonna get into it, but.
This guy
I stole some
stuff from Freddie, though. Honestly.
You know what I'm saying? But when did you?
You my naysayer.
He's a naysayer.
we all each other naysayers. But did you know? When did you know?
Man, that's hard to say, honestly, because we all played, and you go through points where you say, man, I think I got it, and then you go through points where you say, damn, I need to get better. Like, can I really excel at this level? By my senior year in college, I knew that I can pretty much do certain things. But you don't know how it translates to the National Football League. Because our perception, at least mine at the time, was, man, these dudes are bigger. You know, they're more physical. They're faster. But, dog, when I got there my rookie year, stuff I was doing in practice, I remember one of the first practices we had. And I hear older guys talk about it now, their first impression of me. So I just did it. One of the first carries I had, I remember the linebacker coming down, you know, middle of the hole, and I spit off of him in the middle of the hole, and everybody on, you know, junior, all those guys was like,
ooh.
He got it. But for me, it was just natural, you know. It didn't tell me that I had it. to me, it was about being consistent. Can you do a year after year? Can you handle a 300 carries a year? That type of thing let me know after a couple years that I got it.
Your mother wrote a book, What Raising a Champion Taught Me, and I want to get into that as we go along. But champion means so many different things. Lorenzo Neal, when he presented you in the Hall of Fame, he said, you know, he's a great player, the greatest player I've been around, but he's a better man, a better person. And I think those things are most important. But to get to what made LaDainian Tomlinson the person, I guess we would have to start at Tomlinson Hill. Mm-hmm. And for people who haven't, you know, seen the football life or haven't read up on it, explain a little bit about what your ancestors and Tomlinson Hill, what is their foundation?
I went on this journey of finding out about my ancestors after my career. Now, it was on purpose. It was thought out. Now, the gentleman that did the story, his name is Stephen Tomlinson. He's an Associated Press writer, the white side of my family. And he befriended my mom a long time ago when I was still playing. And so he started to talk to her about the history of our family. And my mom would come to me every now and then. She would say, babe, she said, Chris Tomlinson, you need to talk to him. And I always said, Mom, I ain't ready for that. Like, I'm in the middle of my career. I'm focused on, you know, trying to win a championship and be the best. I don't want to go down that road right now. I knew it was going to be sensitive to me, right? Because I grew up there. You know, my grandma, you know, my dad, I there were special moments on that slave plantation, you know, acreage, if you will. So I knew what was coming. But I think I got it right around, you know, my last year with the Jets. And I started to think more and more about the future. And I had, you know, a son, had a daughter at that time. And so legacy started to play into my mind. Now, let's be honest. When the time I retired, I had a great feeling. I'm going to go into the Hall in 5 years. What do I want to talk about with this speech? Like, that's going to be part of my legacy, right? And so I eventually sat down and talked to Chris Tomlinson at a Starbucks. You know, he brought out all these artifacts, man, of my family, my great-great-great-granddad getting off the slave ship in Galveston, okay? So I learned that. Got off the slave ship in Galveston, marched to Alabama. He and about 200 slaves went to Alabama to this slave plantation where they served the owner for many years. Now, how my family got to Tomlinson Hill, one of the daughters were getting married. The father wanted her to have some land. It happened to be in Tomlinson Hill. So my great-great-great-granddad was one of the slaves that was picked to move them down there. So they marched from Alabama to Chilton, Texas, wow, where Tomlinson Hill is. And from that point on, that's where my family was originated from.
That is such a wild story. And the fact that you actually got to trace, you know, your ancestry back to that, but have someone who shares your last name, shares some of your heritage, take you through that journey. I can't imagine, though, the emotion of seeing and knowing that that was what
the people went through. But Ryan, let me tell you why it was so emotional. Because when I saw the old broke down slave quarters that my great-great-great-granddad lived in, it was like I had flashbacks of running around that property for family reunions and whatnot. And it was so weird. It was eerie, bro. It was like,
At the time you were there, though, LT, you didn't know that that was your history at the time. So you were running around the plantation, running around the acreage, and that was the places where your great-great-grandfather served.
Tended the fields and served. Wow. Yes. And that's what, and you know the first thing I thought about, God, why me? Why you put me in this position to take my family name as far as I've taken it? And I felt guilty that my great-great-great-granddad lived like this, like had to go through this. But at the same time, I knew it was a sacrifice, obviously, that all of our ancestors went through so that we can have the opportunity to do what we're doing now.
A.L.T., though, man, Tomlinson Hill, no disdain. Like, as you say it, like, it's, but your great, 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 great grandfather, like, y'all are slaves on this plantation. Yeah. And you're looking at it like you're, as you say it, you're praising it. And as I read about it, I'm like, God damn, I don't want to be there. This is where my, be honest, they got beat, whooped, whatever it was, like, the pride that you take in it, why is it from there? Why, how was that emotion there?
Well, it took a while to get there. And remember I said it took me a while to even talk to him because I knew what was coming. I knew it. You know, my dad gave me little crumbs growing up, you know, what how I was. I remember my dad telling me one story that even when he was a little boy, now my dad was born in 1935, okay? So even when he was growing up, his dad still worked for, you know, a white man and pretty much doing slave stuff, carrying hay, tending to the fields. And my dad wasn't allowed to go to the fields. You know, that was off limits. But one time he snuck up there. And, you know, the slave owner actually almost slapped my dad for being there. And so he would tell me little stories of how he was treated growing up. So it took a while, Channing, to get there. You know, like I said, man, it was emotional because I just felt like it wasn't fair that I was in this position and they had to go through that. Mm-hmm. But I knew it had to be a reason. I'm a spiritual person at the end of the day. So I have to trust that there's always a reason God does something.
You said having those conversations with your mom, you weren't ready during your playing years. Well out of retirement, you have kids of your own. Have you had those conversations with them yet?
Yeah, yeah. I think it's important to have those conversations. They have seen the story. Football life. You know, I think it gives them great perspective for where they are now in life and the schools that they attend, which is the majority white schools, you know. And so I think it's important for them to be prideful young people about who they are, where they come from. Don't let nobody tell you anything different. You know who you are, you know where you come from, and you always walk with humility. But also be prideful about who you are and where you come from at the end of the day, you know? And so I think that's important that they understand that. Because y'all know, like I know, people out there in the world that don't know you, they're gonna put you down, they're gonna tell you all type of things that you're not, that you can't be. And so it's up to us as parents to make sure they understand who they can be.
You know, LT, you did get an opportunity to go to Tomlinson Hill and sort of understand and learn the history of your family, but I want to go back to your father. You know, your father passed at the height of your career, right? At the peak of who you were as a football player. And, you know, you took that extremely hard because it was sort of after a story comes out that almost painted you as the superstar football player who forgot about his people, who at least forgot about his father. How did that affect you and the timing of everything happening the way it did?
Oh, tremendously, Ryan. It affected me tremendously. Not to mention the own demons that I was fighting with within myself of just getting to know my dad at that time. You know, like, you know, I grew up where my dad had two families. You know, he had a family before he married my mom. And so I had older brothers and sisters. And my dad, I didn't know at the time, but he felt like one family needed him more than the other, okay? He said to me one time, son, I knew your mom was strong, you know, that she had y'all. Like, she was going to be able to do whatever it took to take care of you guys. My other family, they needed me more. Wow. I had to be there. And because growing up, I always wondered, like, why my dad not coming around? Like, you know, I struggle, Ryan, with, you know, a little depression, not knowing why my dad not around. He don't love me. Like, why he don't come to my games? All that type of stuff I had to deal with, not knowing. So when I got to college and I was able to call my dad and say, Pop, what you doing? Pop, son, I'm sitting on this porch, coming over. Just want to sit with you. Just want to sit with you. Didn't know the man that much, right? Got a chance throughout them college years, my last 2 years, to really get to know the man, okay? He had so many struggles. Now, people say, I forgot about it. If they knew how many times I tried to have my dad come, live with me.
You wanted him to come to San Diego?
I wanted him to come to San Diego. He was prideful. He had another family, brothers and sisters that he had to be there for. He wasn't going to leave the country. That was the pride about who he was. Like, he wasn't running away from his family to come live with his superstar son.
Yeah.
That's not the perfect story, you know, that he felt like he, you know, that was just how he was. So when he died, Ryan, not only did I feel like I was shorted not being able to finish getting to know him, but I felt like I couldn't change his mind of getting him to come stay with me. And I struggled with that for a long time. But at the end of the day, my pop was he was a strong-willed man that, you know, was kind-hearted, but at the same time, he understood who he was. Mm-hmm. And that was a man of his family.
He used to go check for Super Bowl tickets because he knew they was going to come one day.
They weren't coming.
Yeah, they didn't come.
No, that was coming. The year, though. That, if the you 14, remember, 14-2. We're up on the Patriots by 11 in the fourth quarter. Marlon McCree intercepts the Tom Brady, and he's running back. We're all like, get down. Troy Brown pokes the ball out. They get the ball back with about, I want to say, 5 minutes. Brady goes down and scores, okay? They kick an onside kick, get it back.
That's the Patriot stuff, though.
Kick a field goal.
But then you went for like 143 early.
I was killing them, Ryan. I was killing them. They weren't going to get the ball back.
Yeah.
No, we were smashing the Patriots. Go back and look at it.
Yeah.
We was in control of the game. And so that was the year that my pop was talking about. He really felt like that was the year. Because we would have had the Colts at home that next game. And if y'all remember, we owned the Colts at that time.
Yeah.
Because the way y'all played ball, though.
The way we played.
Y'all ran it?
Yep.
Yeah, I got after
Payton. And we got after Payton, absolutely.
Yep.
That's back when y'all was running that goddamn power over and over and over and over.
Smarty, man.
Yeah, that's why I like to call it the curse of the Chargers, because they did Marty wrong. You don't go 14-2 and get fired. Like, that should never happen.
Your star player don't go from 47% of the touches to 31 the next year, neither.
Well, let's dive a little deeper into that, okay?
Okay.
Because, you know, Marty, we've had time to process it and think about certain things.
You went from Marty to North Turner.
But remember, who's the offense coordinator? You guys remember at that time? Cam Cameron.
Oh, don't say that.
Did he not get – what job did he get right after we lost?
He came and be my head coach, and that bitch is terrible. I couldn't even, I wouldn't, listen, that bitch was on fire, I wouldn't piss on him. That bitch was terrible, LT.
Cam's so a good in dude, my, man.
You always got to couch it when somebody do bad at their job, that they're great human, they love their kids. You got to couch that shit, bro.
So in my mind, did we just throw the game for a head coaching job?
Ooh.
Let's
finish now. If we lose now, I get to go take my interviews. I get to go take a job.
You play football a certain way if you're up by 11, or if you're up in the second half. Freddie T, what we doing?
Tote that thing.
We toting that thing.
Yep.
How do I not get the ball?
Lorenzo said, Lo'Neal said, that if you'd have got it more in the second half, y'all win the game.
And that's why I said we have all had a chance to think about this stuff, process it. And the fact that, you know, someone gets it right after we lose. Guys, I appreciate everything. You know, you guys play hard for me. I'm going to take this Miami job. What?
Yeah.
They'll always question the players' heart and commitment when players jump and make those moves, but you know, you don't hear much of it when coaches make those rash type decisions.
I tell y'all, it's funny, this conversation. When Saban went back to college, went to Alabama, we played the Indianapolis Colts that last game. His second year, 06, we played the Colts, Peyton and them, they wore our ass out. They whooped the fuck out of us. And we knew, you know, it was Peyton up there, Dallas Clark was about to play action and hit my ass down the seam. I'm running down there looking like an asshole. Saban never smiled in the plane going back from
away games. He never smiled. Like, he was always locked in. The Saban's a hell of a coach. Nick Saban's a great coach. He's probably one of the best defensive minds I've ever set with. But when we left Indy in week 17 in 06, we walk on the plane and Saban and his wife, Terry, were sitting in the front seat and Saban was smiling. And everybody, all the dudes, all the OGs going to the back, we back there playing cards. Everybody like, y'all see Saban smiling? And we was all like, we ain't know what the fuck was gonna happen. We're like, man, this bitch might try to run us tomorrow. The season over. Like, how the fuck we gonna run? Like, we were scared because we never see him smile. That's right before I'm not gonna be the Alabama head coach. And he just left. Mm. So to that point, like, I don't know. I don't know if people think about the coach's decisions. We always criticize what the players do, if they opt out and all that stuff, but the coaches have those same decisions to make. And I saw it with Saban. I'm like, this motherfucker's smiling. What's going on? And then he go and sign a, you know.
Yeah. And he keeps signing them because he keep winning.
Six-figure deal with college, but he's, you know, and he's 80, the, 90
he's the,
million.
He's the greatest he college coach of all time.
Bro, he's a monster.
Seven championships, but it brings me to championships with you. You said you felt like your career was close, but no cigar.
Yeah.
Which, to me, for a Hall of Famer to say, for one of the best players that have ever lived to say, it lets you know how important championships are to legacies. And it seems that that was the one thing you and your father shared as well. It's like, we want to win, and I want you to get to that game. How much does not getting that championship stick with you?
Oh, I think it sticks with me a lot because I knew that I had the teams to do it. Now I realize you have to be a little lucky and things got to go your way, and that's all great. You know, I grew up in Texas. I was a huge, obviously, Cowboy fan. I grew up in the heyday of the Cowboys in the 90s, mid-90s, three championships at that time, watching those games, you know, with family, and you grow up wishing that would be you. Like, I'm going to have my time one day, right? And so, and I'm going to say this, even with the Jets, AFC Championship
right
game,
AFC.
Pittsburgh,
yeah,
goal line, them boys stop us. Yeah. Four straight, goal, we're right there. We
came all the way back
mm-hmm. to have put ourselves in that position to not win it. So it's tough to live with. But, you know, I do remember something that Marty Schottenheimer told me to kind of, I guess, help me deal with not winning it. He says, son, you have championship moments. There were a number of championship moments when you think about it that you had. So appreciate those championship moments and don't beat yourself up about not winning the Super Bowl championship. Mm-hmm. So...
But you also...
when you're that good, it's so hard.
It is. But
he ain't do nothing on those four plays, did he?
I probably didn't. Hey, Sean Green still fought me that game, too. Bro, I was always running up from the middle of the field, and folks were still fought.
You came up so hard. That's why. You came up just...
Because I was little.
You know you got him, bitch. Out the gate.
Much like you said, Marty reminded you that you had championship moments. I want to take the time here to remind you, you were the one of 17 running backs that's won it in the history of the game. Jim Brown won it three times. Mm. So in terms of special moments, that's an extreme rarity. You know, I don't know whether you would trade a trophy for being in that exclusive category, but I digress. I want to know about young LT. How did you get into football? I read somewhere that you played fullback.
Fullback and linebacker, outside linebacker in high school. But I was always one of those kids. See, I was inspired by my older brother, Terry, Oliver Terry Thomason was named after my dad, okay? But I always heard these stories, bro, like when I was a little kid, because he was so much older, of how good of a running back he was. Like, he had his jersey retired at the school. Like, that jersey at my grandma's house used to be on the wall, and I used to, as a kid running around the country, always... You know, like, look at that jersey and be like, I'm going to have my jersey on the wall, too, one day. So I was inspired by my brother to play running back. Not to mention that having older brothers and cousins, man, what they did to me, you know, throw that ball out.
Yeah.
Let's go. Like, you know, it was already in me. Now, growing up, early on, I actually played quarterback. But I was the Michael Vick of Pop Warner. All I did was run that thing. You know what I'm saying? Like, that was it. Snap, roll out, and boot around, use that speed, moves. That was it. When I got to high school, I remember going in and sitting down with the high school coach, and he asked me about what position I played. And, you know, I said it with my chest, and I play running back. He said, no, you don't. He said, we got running backs here. We need you to play fullback and outside linebacker. And that was the first time, you know, I got humbled because I was always fastest kid, quickest, all that stuff, right? You ain't gonna play running back. You gotta wait your turn. We had these little 5'5", 5'6" running backs that were quick and all that kind of stuff. So for 2 years, I played fullback and outside linebacker. I'm blocking for these boys. My senior year was the chance I finally got to be the guy. And I went crazy. I had like 2,500, 39 touchdowns, but it was my senior year, so a lot of the bigger schools, LSU and Florida, know me. Right. You know, I did it in 1 year. Mm-hmm. So it was one of those things, I was really a late bloomer.
Yeah, I'm just sitting over here smiling because my career kind of went that way. I was fullback, I was linebacker my sophomore year. And then they put me over to tailback after Gilbert left. He was a Gatorade All-American, like 10 flat 100.
Well, Freddie T, that's because you were 230 in high school.
No, I was 212. I was 212.
He was 212
still, though, in high school?
I was 212.
Dog, that's...
Then you was out there playing people KK size.
LT.
Dog.
10-200 meters.
Hey.
But
10-2, 4-2 at 215.
But let me ask you this, Freddie T. Did you enjoy playing linebacker? Because I did.
It was fun.
Like, I mean, I really... Outside linebacker, I'm rushing. I'm coming off that end.
That was...
I'm coming. Yeah.
That was the reason I didn't go to UM. They recruited me as a linebacker after my sophomore year. I was like, I want to play. I want to run this rock.
Yeah.
But I didn't mind playing linebacker. It was a chance to get on the field. You know, everybody who play, you see... people in the stands, they want to come see you play, so you want to be a part of the pep rallies. I want to be a starter, so I just did whatever to get on the field, so linebacker was it. I know Chan got a question.
Let me tell both y'all, both y'all Hall of Fame motherfuckers, y'all wouldn't be as rich as y'all are if y'all jumped in the linebacker
That's
position.
That's true.
So that ball draws a crowd, and that ball draws a fucking check.
But so, Chan, think about this before you ask this question. I was so close in college to switching positions. I remember... After my freshman year, there was an argument between the staffs of me going to play safety because that, you know, I was a good athlete. And so they was like, man, he would be a hell of a safety. Offensive coach is like, hell no. No, he's staying on this side of the ball. So they actually were arguing in the staff meeting about me switching over. Could you imagine?
No.
One, you probably would have been really good at that too. But the world would have been robbed of one of the greatest sights.
I'm gonna transfer.
I'm about to tell some stories right now.
I'm gonna transfer.
It's three running backs in the room. Chan had his hate.
We ran a V option though, so I just ran it straight fucking
line. Jamal Anderson at that.
Yeah.
Look at his knees. Look at his knees.
Yeah, you see these badass knees now.
What weirdo stuff did you do to sort of train yourself without actually training to play football? Like, for example, what I did was gum drops that dry up on the sidewalk or cracks on the sidewalk, I'd be walking down making moves on them. Or I, like, run upstairs. Like, we stayed upstairs in an apartment.
What did he just say?
Yeah,
use the juke out gum drop.
And the cracks in the sidewalk. Man. I don't want to step on them. Like, that was
like step on the crack, break your mama back?
I just didn't want to step on the crack or the gumdrops. And that was like, I would do that the whole way. My
to
grandmother.
To work on your moves.
Fred, yeah, I just didn't know
what I was doing.
Fred, you ain't had no friends.
That was something that excited me. My grandmother sent me to the
book. Yeah, nobody to play.
You had no friends.
Listen, my grandmother sent me to go get, to swap out the food stamps for cash to buy, you know, stuff.
Two for
like,
one.
All two the way, two miles yeah. walk. Like this the whole way, just because. But when I got back home, we stayed upstairs, and that third step was the high step. It was two short steps and a big old step. It was always a challenge to jump on that step and go, bah, 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 bah. I was working on quick feet and didn't know it. So that was sort of the evolution getting me ready for running back. That's why I asked, what was something weird that you did as a youngster?
Not like that, but we played a lot of sideline kill. I don't know if y'all remember. Y'all probably didn't call it that.
We played throw a tackle.
Throw a tackle.
We played that too, but so we would play in the street, okay? If you got on the sideline by that grass, you live.
You playing in the street. You touch him.
If you get, by the grass, it's live. You can get tackled. Hmm. And so it was a creative way, right? Wow. It was a creative way of teaching you how to run that thing, you know, and making sure that you were able to maneuver in the street, LT. But also on the sideline.
That's country as hell.
It is country as
hell. Y'all made that joke up. That is not a real game. Nowhere else.
Hey, sideline kid.
That is not a real game. Nowhere else. They was bored.
They had a lot of time. Freddie and Bill Glaze and from bumfuck Texas. I don't know where you from.
Marlon and Waco.
Chilton, Marlon, Waco, that whole little Central Texas area.
Yeah, yeah. And I told you the story before, man. I got to tell you, Zach Thomas.
My guy.
Zach is he's a bad motherfucker. That's my big brother. We get together all the time. That's my man. I played with Zach for 4 years, and he called everybody their numbers. I told y'all this story before. He told everybody numbers. Even Tom Brady was 12. You know what I'm saying? Randy Moss was 8'4". And we came out to San Diego. That was 06. Definitely had the records and all that stuff. And Nick Harwood, I fuck with Nick to this day. He was pulling around that corner. He was the center that could pull and all that stuff, bro. Y'all ran that power. And it was the first time that Zach Thomas ever gave a title to somebody was you. So I played with Zach. And all the time, bro, we playing dogs every week. And he'd be like, hey, 2-3 like to bounce. And Zach would give me little gems. And I remember we came to San Diego to that raggedy-ass Qualcomm Stadium. Qualcomm Stadium was raggedy as fuck. Had that little bitty ass.
Locker room was trash.
Stairs going up. Qualcomm was shit. And it was the first time, and this shit scared me, LT. It was the first time we get on offense first. And we go out there, we warm up, and Zach still hitting me with Rivers and all. You know, y'all had them boys.
Gates
was a dog, 8'5". He called Gates 8'5".
Yeah.
And I gotta cover this in slot. And I'm like, this is about to kill me. They better not throw backside. We sitting there, and Zach Thomas looked down. It was the first time, the whole time we playing together, he looked down. He said, CC, LT for real. And I said, huh? I literally got scared. I was like, what did you just call him? He said, LT's for real. And that's when y'all ran that power, and I told her, we were talking the other day, bro, I hit you at the line of scrimmage. Boom. And I grabbed you, and you motherfucker pumped your feet. And I looked up. I thought I got a tackle early,
because we were going to start with that power.
Bro, like, y'all
so
gonna
I
run.
Know you talking. It was early.
Y'all are going to run that power. I think y'all ran the power like 7 times in a row or something that game. Bro, I hit him at the line of scrimmage, RC. And I got up, and I had a tackle, so I made the tackle. Should I get back? No, they say second and two.
eight yards later.
Nigga just ran with for 8 yards with me?
With me.
And I got this motherfucker about 50 pounds. And that's the thing, bro. Like, man, from that point forward, like, I saw and we were watching, and even we're playing other teams that ran power, I would go back and watch y'all weeks after weeks to see how you see it, to see when that wheel linebacker comes across that center, when y'all cut back, see that thing. Like, I used to watch every single drill
but every
of
back
you.
Couldn't do that.
Yeah.
You know, every back can do that because that you got to have that lateral movement to be able to get back there because it happens so quick. When y'all run over that top like that, you can't be stuttering and trying. You got to and go, you know, because y'all going to redirect. Them defensive linemen's coming off the, you know, off them blocks too.
I use both of y'all all the time when I'm training DBs. And we're doing like lateral plyometrics and things like that. I'd be like, look, man, it's like everybody's worried about having these quick feet. I said, what changes the game is covering ground.
Right.
I said, if you can stick your foot in the ground here and be there, then that's an issue.
Yeah.
Right. And so I was like, those are the best sort of players. And I was like, and those are the players you got to get on the ground. And so both of y'all could do that with the best in the world. I do want to talk about a moment that was different for us to see. Right, we'd always seen you scoring, you know, 31 touchdowns in one season, MVP. You hurt your MCL before a huge playoff game, right? And the visual of that game is you in the coat, the dark visor with the helmet on, the entire game. Take me through what you were feeling that year in the playoffs.
Oh, man, it was probably one of the most disappointing times of my life. Now, I knew I had an uphill battle, you know, trying to play with an MCL like that. And I remember the week before we're playing the Colts, man, and it's early in the game, and I go to spin off a tackle, and Robert Mathis is coming behind me, and he lands on me, my knee buckles. And it felt funny, you know, and I'm like, I think I'm okay. And so I tried to play through it at that time, but as a runner, you just, it's your money. You know, this is our money. Thinking to myself at that time, okay, let me try to rest up for 6 days and you know, get my trainers in here, have them working on me every day, and I think I'll be okay. I went into the game thinking, it's 50-50. Now, wasn't sure if I could make it through the game, but I knew I had to try. This is the AFC Championship game. Had to try. One of the first plays, we run power. Teddy Bruschi, he knew. Went straight down, hit that knee again, okay? Re-injured it. Went off. The next series, tried again. We ran a screen play, okay? I turn around, catch the ball. Look back, there's nobody there. Teddy Bruschi is coming from the inside. Freddie T, I couldn't outrun him. Like, you know, I'm limping. I couldn't get there, you know? And so at that time, we had Michael Turner, Bernard Turner.
Yeah.
I said, Mike, you gotta take us, man. I said, I can't go. And the reason why, Ron, I kept that helmet on, so disappointed in myself that I didn't want to show any facial expressions of, you know, like I'm already a private person anyway. So the camera and all that kind of stuff, people speculating, that was my cover. That was my shield. Disappointment for myself, you know, and dealing with everything. I'm thinking at that time that I just let my team down not being able to go. And knowing that, can't do nothing about that, man.
That AFC Championship was the one Phillip played with the ACL.
Right.
Right? And if you're listening to the media and watching the coverage of that game, they tried to compare those two things. One, you have a quarterback that doesn't move anyway, right? Like, unless Phillip making babies, he ain't really tripping about moving a lot, right? And then you have one of the most explosive running backs to ever play the game who admittedly said, I couldn't outrun Teddy Bruschi. How difficult was it for you to deal with all the noise and criticism of you after that AFC Championship game?
Well, I really wasn't, like, I didn't really care about that. I knew what was real, you know, and so I never really got into the whole criticism. You know, it's disappointment for me because I'm the captain. Captain, you know, and I can't be out there, right? And but I did struggle a little bit with Phillip had the knee. Why couldn't I have the shoulder? A shoulder, I mean, ribs, I done played through every ACs, crack ribs. Nothing you can do about the knees. Nothing you can do. And so realizing I let my team down, but I never really cared about the criticism that everybody was talking about at that time.
And it's something, even running back, and Fred, we talk about it with it, and then Ricky Williams, too. Yeah. Bro, were you ready to be as famous as you got?
No. I mean, I was used to kind of flying under the radar. And even in San Diego, it was known to be a more chill place. Didn't get a lot of media attention, not like on the East Coast. You know, and so I felt like I was in a good position to just kind of be who I was, you know. But I think I took it how it went at that time. Started to get a lot of marketing deals, television commercials, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, for me, I didn't really think about how famous, you know, I was becoming. It was just like striking when it's hot.
Yeah.
Because there's two games that you have to play. You got to play the game on the field, but you also got to play it off the field. You got to play that game as well.
Yeah.
And I knew I had the opportunity at that time to play that game off the field.
How much truth is it to you turning down the Madden cover?
It's all true.
That was in 08, correct? Or
08.
It was 07, I think. Yeah, something like that.
Said it wasn't enough money.
Why did you? Yeah,
wasn't enough money.
That's why.
I felt like my value was higher than what they were asking me to do at the end of the day. And I've always turned down things that I didn't feel like would value who I am, who I was at the time. And so I wasn't going to sell out for Madden, you know, if I felt like they weren't giving me what I deserve. Especially all the stuff that they ask you to do, the shoots, all that stuff, to me, it just wasn't worth it.
I got asked, nigga, you know, I'm like, what was the number?
I don't even remember. I know it was six figures.
And they about to make a billion off.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I want I want to get, you know, you gotta get a million at least.
You ever believe in that?
No, they say though, stand on business.
I read it.
Yeah, I'm the MVP.
Yeah.
I've done things that
Walter Payton Man of the Year. Yeah. Only player that has ever done that. MVP and Walter Payton Man of the Year. Like, yeah. Give me what I deserve.
You ever believe in the Madden curse though?
Nah.
No, I didn't.
I never believed in it. But you know, it was weird that it kept happening. Right? Like, it was weird. Like, everybody that got on there,
yeah.
You know, and people speculate, oh, that's the reason why he turned it down. It wasn't. But, yeah. Did you believe in it?
Nah. I mean, shit, I was getting hurt and I wasn't on it. I'd be
like, hey, you about to try something different. I'm pretty sure.
Do the reverse.
Freddie should have got on that bitch and see if he did get hurt.
I'm sitting over here like, damn, that my dog over there snapping and going crazy. I need to stay healthy to get over there. Nah. Bring that cover, man.
Dog, you know what I remember real quick? We playing Freddie T that one time, and I remember, because, man, Freddie was my guy, man. I loved to watch him, you know, because he did things that I wanted to do, you know, movements and explosion through the hole and all that kind of stuff, right? And I did something one time. I think I, you know, hit somebody, spent or whatever. And I saw Freddie T on the bench, and I kind of looked at him. He smiled. He's like,
hey, was that when y'all blew us out?
Yeah.
Hey, I'm sitting over there the same time, like, God damn, that's supposed to be me. That's that, because they run into play, saying, A got the A got that power, key in that wheel. If that boy come down, the wheel going to go over. Now, if you lean it up just right and get them all, now you one-on-one backside with the safety, ta-ta, and you. Like, you getting it.
I'm going to be honest.
You know what I'm saying?
So, I thought y'all got the football and ran the daylight.
No,
like,
sir.
I the fact that y'all actually paid attention to the wheel, you know, that you tell me you would watch Casey's, wherever Casey was shade, to know, like, all that stuff to me. Like, I was like, man, these dudes just fast and powerful, and they just hand them the ball and they run.
No, it's leverage. It's knowing the blocking assignment, what the double teams are. You want to hug those tight. And when they slither off and get up to the next level, you want to be right there, being able to make some moves. So,
but you know what? And that's when my game went to the next level, when I knew what y'all were going to do. You know, I can tell, you know, sometimes right before the play, if y'all cheating over a little bit and the eyes go to a certain play, oh, he coming to that gap. Okay, so I'm going to hold him there, and then I'm going to know that my block's coming here, and I'm going to bounce that thing so hard. And, you know, you play games like that.
Crazy.
And the other thing is, in the passing game, I learned from Marshall Faulk. Marshall lived in San Diego. I spent a lot of time with Marshall Faulk on routes and stuff. So I'm telling you, like, it's clear as day. I knew every time when I ran that H-post route or that option who was going to cover me. I look out there, oh, you know what I'm saying? And what looked like cover three at safety right there. Oh, they're going to bracket me here. Oh, they're not... Oh, okay, that's safety for the run down late. He going to have me man-to-man. I'm finna give it to him. You play the game like that in your mind before it happens. And then when it's happening, you're not surprised when it's a big play. You done already. It's like the Matrix.
On the backside of trips.
It's different.
On the backside of trips, I had you man-to-man one time.
Cake.
No, listen. It makes me look bad, but it looks good and bad after the end. Anyway, you run the option route. I stay inside, out a couple of feet, whatever. You break to the sideline, and you catch the ball. And I end up, luckily, I think I closed my eyes, but I tackled you. And, nigga, I got up, and I'm over there slapping my helmet, and I'm going crazy, and I'm going to the sideline, and the coach is looking at me funny, and I'm like, bitch, why isn't everybody celebrating? It was second down.
You thought it was third down.
I got a to cover this motherfucker again? No, bitch, that's all I did. But that was the part of the game that I didn't know. I was just doing my job.
Yeah.
And I was so excited to be able to tackle you in open field. But like you were saying, you knew exactly what was happening. You saw the safety rotate over top. You saw the three-cover roll, and you knew I was man-to-man backside because we used to roll trips. And that's the
An option we had to go out. You know,
because the trips, are, somebody's coming inside on the trip
exactly.
side, so you got
to
go.
We out. Have to go out.
Yeah, so
you know,
if
especially
had,
if you man.
If you had a real option, I really would never cover you.
You mentioned your faith earlier. You know, I know we was talking about ball. That's like a really big pivot. You mentioned your faith earlier. You're an actor, right? You played a pastor.
Yeah, Pastor Williams.
You know, and you say you drew on things that your mother taught you growing up. Speak a little bit about though that relationship with your mother and just how important that was, you know, for your father to tell you, I was able to go with this other family because your mother was so strong, I knew she had you. That's a powerful statement. It's something you don't want to hear,
right?
But it's a powerful statement about who your mom is and was to you. Tell me a little bit about that relationship.
Golly, man, you know, I think at every step of the way, my mom gave me great crumbs, man. She was so, had so much wisdom. Guys, you know what my mom used to do when I was a kid to kind of keep me out of trouble? She had a way of, in the mornings for breakfast, she would find stories of kids my age, you know, maybe selling drugs, going to jail, getting killed. She would bring that newspaper while I was eating. She would set it down in front of me. I want you to read that story, and she would walk away. And it had a way of, you know, keeping it in reality. Like, you're not untouchable. You go out here, you live in the south side of Waco, anything can happen. So two streets over from where I grew up was one of the biggest drug dealers in my city, in Waco. She knew that. That was her way of saying, hey, you go down this road, this is what can happen. I know you're getting asked to do certain things that you're not supposed to be doing. I know this is going on at this age, but this is how you handle it. And the greatest thing that my mom did was when she truly started to, you know, take her faith seriously and changed her life. See, we grew up and it was cards. It was E&J in the house, you know, parties at my house. And, you know, I'm a kid running around. And I thought that's what it was about. Mm. When she changed the structure of the home and really became a pastor and started leaving those breadcrumbs and you know, giving wisdom and teaching how to deal with your spirituality and, you know, how to be confident in just being who you are, that's when I think, for me, I was able to stay on that path of understanding where I wanted to go and how to do it. I knew how to get there because of her, because of all the different things she would do, you know, with me growing up.
When Lorenzo was talking about what made you a great person, he talked about the teammates you were, the man you were, but he also mentioned his sister, Twyla, and he said that you would go out of your way to whether it's speak to or be around her. And he said, if you asked her today who her favorite player was, even though you were retired, this is, you know, during your induction, that it would be you. What was it about your relationship with Lorenzo, but also his little sister who was special needs, that made that important to you every time you saw her, anytime she was around, to give extra effort to let her know you acknowledged her, you valued her?
Very experiencing. Growing up with family with special needs. You know, so I had an auntie that had twin girls that were special needs, and they were really close to us, you know, like we grew up together. And so I grew up learning how to take care of them, learning how to do certain things for them, learning how to be careful with their feelings, you know, and all the things that they had to deal with. So it was natural to me for when I first met her to just love on her. You know, just to love on her. I knew how to interact with her. And we built a great relationship over them years. It was really round about the experience that I had in my own family of dealing with special needs kids.
LT, the daddy, right? Because you don't get to be Hall of Famer at your crib.
No, not at all.
You know, when you have the relationship that I guess we can call complicated with your father, and you feel like that is taken away before you get an opportunity to truly know him. And then you see the great parenting, the sacrifice, the crumbs, like you said, of your mother. All of those experiences build us to the fathers that we are and the way we take care of our kids. How did all those things shape you, and how do you implement what you've learned, what you want to be, what you don't want to be, into raising your kids?
Yeah, it, without question, it shapes you. You know, whether you like it or not, it shapes you. You know, but the thing that I have to, like, I struggle with a little bit is, you know, being open, you know, a little bit more with my kids. Because my dad really wasn't too open. You know what I mean? He wasn't present always. And I feel like I'm not always as present as I want to be. Mm. But at the same time, I understand it, and it makes me fight hard against that because I don't want them having the same feelings that my dad have. And so maybe sometimes I overdo it. Like, you know, I pushed myself this past year to be my son's coach at his school, you know, and I don't know if he wanted that. You know what I mean? So that's what I'm doing now. I done took over the off-season program with my son's school. You see what I'm saying? So maybe, am I overdoing it? Maybe a little bit. But this is the way I know how to be a little bit more open, you know, maybe to my kids, sacrifice a little bit more of being present, but just being available to have conversations at the end of the day.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times we want, you know, I want personally what I didn't have as a youth. So I try to have that more in my life. Hall of Fame.
He better than you, Freddie.
Look, I
know. Fred, he's better than you.
I always put LT.
The proof's
come
in the
pudding. Man, why you want to?
Well, like, I just want to know.
That? Why we can't just praise them both?
Fred, RC, we sitting over here, RC, and we lining up against somebody.
I don't want to line up against either
one. I don't want to line up against either one of them. I want to get a duck. But
you know what? I'm going to tell you your best chance is me.
That's
your best
you just
shot
proved
is
my
me.
Point. LT better than you.
I'm telling you that. Your best shot is me.
This guy.
He's always the antagonist. But your best shot is me. But that's going to be a hell of a shot.
I'm telling you.
Can I get my question?
Yeah, let's focus on
that. I saw you going football, and I just want to let the established everybody knows that LT was better than your fucking ass.
You's a motherfucker. How long we been together?
A long time. Fred, I know you for 20.
You know, I'm always...
And I love you to death.
I always give you the nod, dog. You already know that. So, your Hall of Fame speech, 26 minutes. It wasn't a speech. It was more like a sermon. And it came at a perfect time in the country.
It was needed.
Yeah, very much needed. The mindset, like preparation leading up to it. Take us through, you know, those thoughts. How did you develop your speech? Nowadays, I think they're 8 minutes. They're limited to maxed out at eight with those guys. But leading up to it, what were those thought processes? How did they come together?
Well, if you remember, guys, there was a leading up to that over those five seasons of 2012 when I retired to 2017. A lot of social justice issues going on. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of marching in the streets, which I took part in. A lot of, you know, Black Lives Matter. A lot of things going on, right? And I just felt like it wasn't about me. This was my opportunity to say something to the country, to say, you know, what I wanted to say, but also to leave a message. I felt like if this was going to be the last, I went in with the mindset, if this is the last message, if this is the last thing I ever say, you know, what do I want to say? And I wanted to, you know, I really wanted to leave that legacy of this is what I care about. Like, this is how I feel like we should move forward. And having that locker room feel of, you know, how we approach everything, like, it doesn't matter what color you are, it doesn't matter, you know, your sexuality, who you love, who you don't. It's about coming together for one common goal. That's why I came up with that term, Team America. You know, the idea of, if we cared about our neighbor, you know, more than we cared about ourselves, if we all took that approach, then, you know, it would be a better world and all that kind of stuff. But I also wanted to point out some things that were going on that were hurting the community, that were hurting my community, mm-hmm. things that I were going that I was going through. And then obviously I had to touch on, you know, my ancestors, you know, kind of what they had been through and just tie it all together. And man, I think it really came out the way that I wanted it to amazing. Come out. And I'm gonna tell you, man, it was such a heavy moment for me. After I got off stage, I was inconsolable and crying. I'll tell you, it was one of the weirdest things that I ever felt, because I felt like my dad, my granddad, great-granddad, all that pressure, the spirit, for whatever reason, I felt it at that time, you know, and it was powerful. It was really powerful. I had never felt that before.
It had to be a thing that brought you some pride, though, that to know and have found out what that name meant, how you got that name. Now that name is forever enshrined in Canton, Ohio, in the Hall of Fame. And it shows how people sacrifice for us to get opportunities to be something different, to be something more, to be something better. And every now and then, we make it right. And it's never going to change what history is. History is history,
yeah.
right? We don't get to change it. We get to learn about it. We get to teach our kids about it. But we do get to work in the present to make sure we give them their deference, we give them their appreciation for what they had to go through, mm-hmm. right? And I think you got a different perspective than a lot of us get. And the fact that you go forward with that thinking outside of yourself is huge. I think we always ask this question, so we're going to ask you the question. What's your biggest pivot? What's the moment in your life that you felt like you either needed or it jolted you, whether it was negative or positive, that propelled you to this point, that made you make a decision to get to this point? But what is that moment in your life, that greatest pivot, that gives us the LaDainian Tomlinson we see today?
Wow. Oh, man. So when I was a freshman in high school, I went to church every Sunday, and, you know, was that kid, because my mom was a pastor, was that kid that was like, you know, going to church again, like, we're going to be there for 3-4 hours, you know. Really wasn't into it like that. I mean, I'm a teenager, you know, I'm ready to get home, play the game, watch football. So this one particular Sunday, the pastor, you know, gets to preaching and you know, there's people shouting, you know, in Southern churches, you're going to shout, yep. you know, you're going to dance, okay? And so this one particular Sunday, pastor comes down out of the pulpit, and he's laying hands on people, man. You know, he's preaching. He gets to me, lays hands on it, and he says, I'm 14 years old. He says, son, God told me to tell you, He's gonna take you places you wouldn't even imagine. If you honor him, I'm gonna tell you, I started to cry. And I promise you, if I look back on that day, my life changed from that day. I knew where I was heading, man, I'm telling you, because that was the prophecy on my life. And I was huge into that. You know, my mom reminded me, at every step of the way, what was your prophecy on your life? That God would take me places I never imagined if I just honor him. Believe it. And all the way, did he not take me places I never imagined? I'm one in 300 men that has a gold bust. That's the pivot.
That's the show. Y'all, they got chills, don't they?
That's the pivot.
Man, Chris, thank you, my boy.
Still shaking, your knees never shaking.
That's the closest you ever got to him, man.
I see, when I got stuck up on him, he gave me a hug, I tried to break down.
Nice to be so mad, because, you know, we on Central Time. So when you go to church at 8:30, they keep you there 3.5 hours. Right. You missing the start of the game.
No doubt.
I used to be hot, dog. I tell my mama every time, Mom, the Saints game gonna be on by the time we get home.
Hold up. Limitless. Take a stomach cap, pinning it. I fought the head to witness it. Got my people feeling militant. Way I'm feeling, got me up. On the mission, got me up. Knowing me, I got the key. On the vision, I can trust. Trust. Limitless. Take a stomach cap, pinning it. I fought the head to witness it. Got my people feeling militant. Way I'm feeling, got me up. On the